This podcast is brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute.
If you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, review, and share.
Thanks for listening. Here's our show.
What in the hell's going on?
What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
You don't have to know what the hell is on it.
What the hell's the matter with these guys?
We don't know what's going on.
What the hell's going on?
Who in God's name knows what it's all about?
Hi, I'm Danielle Pletka.
And I'm Mark Thiessen.
Welcome to our podcast, What the Hell is Going On? Special edition. Mark, what is not going on?
What is going on is Iran has directly attacked Israel, crossing a line that it has never crossed before. You know, we keep seeing lots of lines getting crossed these days and people being surprised. And we shouldn't be surprised because, look, the Iranians have told us from the get-go that their goal is the destruction of Israel. So this is just another step in the long campaign to wipe Israel off the map. And, you know, it was an ineffective attack, not because the Iranians intended to be an ineffective attack, because you don't generally lob 190 missiles at a country and expect none of them to get through, or very few of them to get through. It was an ineffective attack because of the ballistic missile defenses and other technologies and U.S. support and other countries that came together to shoot down all the missiles and stop it from being effective. I remember when Barack Obama was president and he drew that red line in Syria that the Syrians will not use chemical weapons or else we will launch a military strike on Syria. And then the Syrians said, ha! And they used chemical weapons on their people and said, what are you going to do about it? A senior Obama official was quoted in one of the newspapers saying, we're contemplating an attack just muscular enough not to be mocked. That is not what the Iranians did here. This was a very, very large-scale, combined drone, rocket, and ballistic missile attack that was intended to inflict damage. And it only didn't because of the skill of the Israelis and the U.S. military and some other allies in the region who stopped it.
Well, but also, look, the Iranians gave us the opportunity to pre-position as well. We moved a carrier into the Med. We had Aegis cruisers that were able to shoot down missiles. We had a lot of warning. The Israelis had a lot of warning. Now, I like to think that in any event, even if the Iranians hadn't telegraphed what they were doing, we would have known, because Iranian decision making is reasonably transparent to the Americans and to the Israelis. But, you know, this was a much more serious thing than I think people are giving credit for. I saw the Israelis absolutely spiking the ball. The first and only football analogy you will ever hear me use. I saw the Israelis spiking the ball afterwards, and yeah, okay, as a matter of propaganda, go for it, spike the ball. But as a matter of real analysis, let's be serious. Why do the Iranians have 170 drones to spare, 120 surface-to-surface ballistic missiles, and over 30 cruise missiles, which, by the way, cost a pretty, pretty penny? Because there are no serious sanctions in place. The Iranians have earned almost $100 billion in extra money because the sanctions that were in place during the Trump administration aren't in place, because we have no Iran.
Didn't Biden just release like a lot of money just recently to the Iranians?
That there's some back and forth going on about whether that happened. But certainly the Biden administration intended to, because there was a payoff for hostages. You know, all of this is a disaster. And I cannot understand, when I read the newspapers, when I watch the TV, I cannot understand how it is that everybody is patting themselves on the back that this was a huge success. Iran, with very sophisticated weaponry, just attacked Israel, and it required Israel, the United States, France, the UK, and potentially the Jordanians and others who also contributed their airspace to actually beat this back. Okay? That is not a good scenario.
So the question we don't get into with our guest, which we probably should have, but I'll ask you because you're an expert in this region. What are the Israelis going to do? The attack happened. It did minimal damage because of the skill of the Israeli and U.S. defenses. What do they retaliate against Iran proper now? Do they stand down and say they take this as a victory, as the Biden administration is encouraging them to do? What happens?
Well, as you know, Escalation Joe is very nervous about that. And one of the first things he said to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when they talked on Saturday night was, okay, this was tit for tat. In other words, he said, and I'm not sure folks paid attention to this, so let me step back for a second and say, the Iranian mission to the United Nations, in other words, Iranian diplomats stationed in New York, tweeted out at the end of the Iranian barrage against Israel that their operation was over and that the tat had been given to the tit that the Israelis had triggered by killing this IRGC general, and now it was all over and everything was finished, and if the Israelis choose to restart it, well, then there was going to be hell to pay. This is exactly
the line. U.S. stay out of it in all caps, Trump style, all right. Caps.
This is exactly the line that Joe Biden took. We're not going to be involved in anything, and now this is all over, Israel, so don't do anything. Now, the Israelis are not going to listen to Joe Biden because no one listens to Joe Biden. And if you recall, the Iranians, he told the Iranians, quote unquote, don't. And to quote every single person on Twitter, they did. Exactly. But I think the Israelis are trying to calculate what it is that they're going to do. I think the Israelis are trying to figure out what will bloody the Iranians' nose without provoking a yet another exchange with the Iranians. And for me, I will tell you what I would say if I were sitting in the sit room in Tel Aviv beneath the Israeli Ministry of Defense. I would say take out the Iranian drone facilities because, A, you will harm Iran's exports to Russia. Those drones are being used to great effect by the Russians against Ukraine. They were used to lesser effect by Iran against Israel, but that won't always be the case. As we will learn from our guest, everybody, including incompetent militaries, learn from their experiences. So that's what I think the Israelis ought to do.
Can we take on the whole tit for tat argument since you brought it up?
You just want to say tit again.
I know. This is why we have an explicit rating. So the argument has been made by the general morons on Twitter, some of whom have PhDs in foreign policy and some of whom pretend to, that this was a legitimate response by the Iranians to an Israeli military strike against an embassy. Against a diplomatic facility, and that any country would have done the same. And I've heard one esteemed former U.S. Army colonel compare this to what Israel did to the Al-Qaeda bombings of our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, which is so dumb as to almost not validate a response. But they took out a IRGC Quds Force headquarters in Damascus and took out a Quds Force commander who, just very much like the Trump administration did with Qasem Soleimani, in this case, one who is directly involved in the planning of the October 7th attacks. So this would be like the United States taking out an Al-Qaeda leader who was an Al-Qaeda operational commander who was involved in the planning of 9/11. Am I right?
You are 100% right. This is a completely spurious argument. You know, I have noted the habit of the anti-Semites on American campuses and in Congress and in the press using Hamas and Iranian language in describing what is happening in Gaza. And it is striking to me that the press wholesale is adopting the Iranian language about this strike in Syria. Okay, guess what, guys? If you're planning terrorist operations from an embassy compound or from a quote-unquote diplomatic facility. It's not a diplomatic facility. Okay, you don't get immunity. It's not like when you played tag in third grade and you got to grab a hold of something and you were safe. That's not how it works. Okay, and we've learned that many times by rogue nations that use their embassies to plan terrorist operations. This is a regular Iranian habit, and we have always called bullshit on it. But all of a sudden, this is a consulate. I'm sorry, if you're planning terrorism there, you should probably reckon out that there's a target on your roof and prepare to die. And the idea that Americans are parroting Iranian propaganda is shameful.
I couldn't agree more. We also get into a discussion of Ukraine. So Fred Kagan, who's our guest today, is an expert on military matters, both in the Middle East and in Russia. And he's just come back from Kyiv. And one of the points that he makes in our discussion is, guess what? You don't get to be an Iran hawk and a Russia dove. You don't get to be a Russia hawk and an Iran dove. And we've got this hypocrisy on both sides, and the Democrats and the Republicans. You've got a lot of Republicans who say, we stand with Israel. What happened on October 7th is horrible, completely ignoring what happened in Bucha, which was the same as what happened on October 7th. Literally, rapes, murders, people being burned alive, all the same atrocities. But we're not going to help those people, but we got to stand with Israel. And then you've got, because you've got this anti-Semite caucus in the Democratic Party that's putting pressure on them, a lot of Democrats who are getting cold feet on helping Israel, but they definitely want to help us defeat Russia and Ukraine. And why do both parties, can't people see that these things are interconnected? Because the Russians and the Iranians don't see them as separate because they're helping each other. The Iranians are sending drones to Russia to kill Ukrainians, and the Russians are helping the Iranians who are using weapons to kill Israelis. Why do we see this as connected and some people can't?
It's inexplicable to me. It really is. You know, these are not dumb people, and well, some of them are, but not all of them are. And it is simply inexplicable. Anyway, it's willful blindness. Folks, we are super lucky because our own Fred Kagan has been immersed in studying not simply what's been going on with the Russian war on Ukraine from Kyiv, but also deeply immersed in analyzing with our friends from the Institute for the Study of War what happened this weekend in the Iranian attack on Israel. Everybody knows who Fred is. He's the director of the AI Critical Threats Project. He's a former professor of military history at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He is the author of the 2007 report, Choosing Victory, A Plan for Success in Iraq, which was the architecture of the winning surge strategy. Fred knows how to win wars, and we're going to talk about that, but we're also going to talk about how to lose them.
Here's our interview.
Fred, welcome back to the podcast.
Good to be back.
Thank you for joining us at short notice. There's a lot going on in the world. You're just back from Ukraine. Iran just attacked Israel from its soil for the first time in the history of the Islamic Republic. I want to start with Israel, because I think that you working together with the folks at the Institute for the Study of War and our own critical threats team put together an extraordinarily important report that basically upends all of the conventional wisdom. What we're seeing in the headlines and all over the news is, well, the Iranians really calibrated this attack to restore their honor in the face of the killing of one of their senior Revolutionary Guard generals, and that they really didn't want to do a lot of damage. They didn't want to provoke the Israelis. They didn't want to start a wider war. And what you're saying is, well, they may not have wanted to start a wider war, but they certainly intended to do some serious damage. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I think it's important to look at the Iranian strike package on Israel in the context of the strike packages we've seen the Russians experimenting with against Ukraine. It's hard at this stage of air and missile defense to get a lot of missiles and drones and stuff through modern air defenses to their targets. And even in Ukraine, which has had limited numbers of U.S. Patriots and other advanced systems, has been able to take down high proportions of Russian, Iranian-made Russian-used drones, and also some North Korean ballistic missiles, as well as Russian ballistic missiles and cruise missiles. And the Ukrainians have, when they have had this enough interceptors and systems, they've been fairly successful at intercepting a lot of those. The Iranians have been watching that. We know that there have been IRGC officers in Russia. We know that the Iranians military is talking to the Russian military all the time. The Iranians have been learning lessons. So it's clear that they modeled this strike package on successful Russian strike packages. And the way that you design a strike package like this is you flood the zone with drones and with cruise missiles, knowing that most of them are going to be shot down because they're relatively easy to shoot down. Drones are very slow. Cruise missiles are relatively slow, and you can shoot cruise missiles down from airplanes, among other things. So you expect that most of those will be shot down. But the purpose of those is to distract and overwhelm the air defenders when the ballistic missiles arrive, because ballistic missiles are very hard to shoot down. And the Ukrainian shoot-down rates have been very low. And in general terms, shoot-down rates of large ballistic missile salvos are generally low. So when you look at the strike package, it seems clear to me that the purpose of the package was for the drones and the cruise missiles to overwhelm the Israeli defenders, probably all get shot down, but then that a higher proportion of the ballistic missiles would get through than actually did. I think there are a number of reasons why that didn't happen, and I think it's very dangerous and usually wrong to read into enemy failure the intent to fail. Because here, I think there are very straightforward things that I can understand why the Iranians would not have seen how this was actually going to play out. And very specifically, it's about 1,000 kilometers from the Iranian border to Israel. And we and the Israelis used all of that space to have our aircraft, and we had hundreds of aircraft in the air, to chase down and shoot down the cruise missiles and the drones. Okay, well, everybody's known that you can shoot down drones and cruise missiles from aircraft, but no one has seen that scale of effort over that long a distance to shoot down a package of cruise missiles and drones because, A, the Ukrainians don't have 1,000 kilometers of standoff to do it, and, B, they don't have a lot of airplanes. So as an analyst, what seems clear to me is the Iranians expected that a higher proportion than zero of the drones and cruise missiles would make it through to the Israeli defense umbrella, where they would distract the Israeli defenses when the ballistic missiles arrived, so that a higher proportion of the ballistic missiles get through. What's a higher proportion? Okay, the Ukrainians have generally been shooting down around 10% of the ballistic missiles that come in. All right, I'm sure the Iranians gave the Israelis credit for having better missile defense, which they do. Let's say that you give them 80%. That's 80% on 120 missiles. There's a big delta between the handful of missiles that got through and the 20 or 30 ballistic missiles that the Iranians, I think, could reasonably have expected would get through if this strike had worked. And that's still a limited strike, right? That's still, 20 missiles, it's not hundreds of missiles. Although these are pretty big warheads, some of these things. But that's what I think the purpose of an intended effect of this strike was when you look at it in context. And I just think the Iranians underestimated what we and the Israelis would be able to do, which is alarming because now I think they will recalculate and they will learn from this and they will think about how to deal with the problems that defeated them this time.
So this was not, as a Obama administration official told the New York Times before their planned Syria strike, a strike just muscular enough not to get mocked, which was the Obama plan. But then explain why did they telegraph it? Why did they warn that the strike was coming? I mean, we knew this like 2 days beforehand that they were planning to do it this weekend. And it's a lot of people jump to this conclusion because after Trump killed Qasem Soleimani, he claims that the Iranians launched it. He told them don't retaliate, or I've picked out 52 targets in honor of the every one of the American hostages you took in 1979 inside Iran, and I'll strike Iran. and they reportedly launched a strike at a U.S. base, but told us in advance and told us they didn't intend to hit anything. They just needed to do it in order to, for their own honor. That's probably where the idea came from that this was this. Why is this not that?
They look, I mean, every time anybody does anything to the Iranians are going to retaliate against. The first thing they do is they spend a while telling everybody that they're going to retaliate. That's standard practice, however serious they think the retaliation is going to be. Part of that is domestic. Part of that is aimed at an internal audience. Part of that is regional, trying to control their proxies. And part of it is, yes, they are trying to engage in escalation management of their own. This is also our assessment. They did not want to get into a full-scale war with us or the Israelis. They did want to inflict, I think, a painful strike. So I think the delta that I don't think anyone's talking about, I'm certainly not saying that I think that they wanted to inflict such a painful strike that they would draw the Israelis into a major massive retaliation. They clearly didn't want that to happen. But I do think that they meant to draw blood. I think that they meant to make this hurt. And I think that they failed in that. But as we talk about the warning, okay, so this is another problem the Iranians have. It takes a long time to fly drones from Iran to Israel. If you're going to use a strike package of the sort that they just used and you're going to rely on doing it from Iran, which you're doing because you want to send a message, you're going to give the Israelis 8, 9, 10 hours of warning under any circumstances because they're going to see drones start to take off and then they have the time to chase them. So you can't launch an attack like this as a surprise. By the way, the Russian attacks on Ukraine don't come as a surprise. The Ukrainians see the aircraft taking off. And when I was in Kyiv a little over a week ago, the air raid sirens go off as soon as the Russian aircraft are wheels up off the runways. So nobody achieves surprise in strikes like this. And so the Iranians were going after a combination of psychological effect and various other things. And that's what they do all the time. That doesn't tell me anything about whether they intended to draw blood or not.
So, Fred, there were a number of elements of this that are worth talking about. One of them is, well, this was a big fail for the Iranians, right? They overestimated their capabilities, even taking the ISW assessment that they intended to draw blood. They really only injured a little Muslim girl. Meanwhile, there were images of the Israelis, the Jews, protecting the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and it looks like a bunch of the other hits were little more than craters in the ground. Should the Israelis feel complacent now about their capabilities? Sure, the Iranians are going to learn, but. Are they going to actually step up their capabilities enough to actually pose a threat to the Israelis?
So I'm alarmed at the complacency with which people are discussing this this shoot down, including some senior retired U.S. military officials for whom I have a lot of respect, but who are really talking about this as a vindication of an Iranian missile defense system. I don't read it that way.
And missile defense, by the way, missile defense that Joe Biden tried to kill his entire Senate career. I mean, when Reagan announced SDI, there was no greater opponent than Joe Biden. It was the Obama-Biden administration that cut funding for missile defense. Biden opposed Bush pulling out of the ABM treaty. So, now Joe Biden's great achievement is apparently ballistic missile defense. Congratulations. Sorry, had to jump in there.
Well, hey, listen, I mean, it's no accident, comrades, that the Russians, a.k.a. the Soviets, were leading the charge against U.S. developing missile defense from the very beginning and investing huge amounts of money into getting us not to develop missile defense and then not to field it. We should not be complacent about this. I've watched the Russians go through many iterations of drone and missile strikes against Ukraine. And for a long time, we watched the Ukrainians shoot down pretty much everything that came in. And the Russians got smart. This is what people don't understand. There are ways of outwitting air defense systems. There are ways of outwitting missile defense systems. There are ways of overloading them. And I've seen some of the tracks that Russian drones follow in Ukraine, and the cleverness with which they approach their targets from all directions, and the way that they find gaps and seams in the defenses and then take advantage of that. Determined enemies will find ways to identify and strike the vulnerabilities in your defense systems. So this is, we should not be complacent about this.
Yeah, I guess for me, Fred, it's not simply that there's a learning curve, which we are absolutely seeing in Russia's attacks on Ukraine, which are absolutely getting through. The notion that the Russians start stupid and should stay stupid seems to me to be extraordinarily naive. Only the Italians do that. But see, there are things I can't resist either. But for me, what this reframes, honestly, is the debate about the Iranian nuclear program, the nuclear weapon program. Because, you know, I guess 2-3 weeks ago, not to make this all about me, except it always is, I had a piece in which I wrote, and I think I have not seen anything persuasive to the contrary, that the Biden administration and the Europeans have entirely given up on an Iran nuclear weapon strategy. There's absolutely nothing going on. It's not that we're not even trying to revive the JCPOA, which was a disaster in and of itself. We're not doing that, and we're not imposing new sanctions on Iranian oil exports, which are their main source of revenue. And if you think about this weekend, and you think about a nuclear Iran, and then you add in everything that we know and that you and I have always talked about the Iranian regime. We've got a supreme leader who is very old. In other words, his life is going to be over at some point soon. We've got an extremely aggressive president who is out of touch with, I think, a lot of the global realities that would mitigate any Iranian nuclear strike. And we've got the IRGC, which is, again, not as Islamist, but certainly as aggressive and also out of touch in some ways with the consequences and the realities of the region. This, for me, is apocalyptic.
Yeah, so what this brings to mind for me, Danny, is this is true in the case of the Middle East and in the case of Europe. We actually have to start thinking about how one would fight a nuclear war again, because in order to do deterrence, you have to be willing to have that conversation about what the nuclear war would look like. And the purpose is not to fight the war, the purpose is to deter it. But that's where we need to be mentally in the Middle East already. And this strike was interesting in that respect. So I'm still not clear on exactly how many ballistic missiles got through it. We saw a report that it was about 7, something like that. Okay, 7 out of 120. That gives the Iranian nuclear planners, as it were, a basis to begin calculations about what they can expect to get through in a failed strike. So now because this is what nuclear war is all about. What proportion do you think you'll get through the defenses? Right? Okay. Now, is that going to be a good ratio for them? Well, you know, if it were 7 and they were all nuclear armed and they hit the targets that they wanted to hit, then right. On the other hand, the Israelis have a lot more than 7 nuclear weapons to flip back at the Iranians. The Iranians don't have these kind of missile defenses. That's a bad trade for the Iranians. So as we talk about what the long-term deterrence here is, talking about improving the quality of this missile defense becomes very important, but really starting to think through, because, you know, as you've said to me rightly, no missile defense is 100% effective. And in principle, you know, the number of acceptable nuclear rounds landing on Israel is 0. So, Roger. But we have to play this deterrence game, and we have to think about, you know, how this all works out, which is the other reason why I think it's important for us not to be complacent. And for us to think about how are we going to engage in what is likely to become an offense-defense race in this region, like what we're seeing in Ukraine, so that we can get to the point where it never looks like a good idea for the Iranians to try this, because they don't have any reason to think they're going to get enough through, and they have reason to think the Israelis will just wipe them out at the end of it. That's got to happen anyway, regardless of what you think you can do to stop the Iranians from getting a nuclear program, and I'm not sure what that is at this point. We have to be now thinking about what the long-term deterrence posture actually is in the region. And that's a very scary thought, but that's where we are.
Well, we've crossed a red line, which is, you know, this is the thing that all, you know, foreign policy is not as complicated as so many people think it is. So you got as you describe them, the PhDs in escalation management running things at the White House. And they all think that you need a PhD to understand this. Foreign policy is really simple. Listen to what the bad guys say and take them seriously. I mean, you can go back to Lenin, What Is It to Be Done, where he told us that he was going to build a communist empire in Russia. Hitler wrote Mein Kampf and told us what he was going to do. Osama bin Laden wrote his fatwa in 1996 and told us what he was going to do. Xi Jinping has told us what he's going to do in Taiwan. And the Iranians have told us that they plan to destroy Israel. And now they've crossed the line of actually striking Israel. I mean, do you need to be a PhD to understand this?
Well, since I have a PhD, I think I can say with confidence that...
Sorry, Brad, I didn't mean to besmirch your hard work. I know you work hard for that degree.
No. My point is I know exactly what it's worth. And I can tell you that actually you probably have an easier time understanding this without the PhD. Common sense and logic, as you're saying, common sense and logic are your friends here. I always say that my dad loved to quote, Ohio State football coach Woody Hayes telling his players, let's not be too smart out there. And we're outsmarting ourselves. We need to get out of the business of going for the Nobel Prize in escalation management all the time. And all this hyper-sophisticated calculation, which has got us to a bad place in Ukraine and has gotten us a bad place in the Middle East. This is about deterrence. This is about hard power. This is about demonstrating to our adversaries that we are prepared to take the fight to them if they take the fight to us, and that we're certainly prepared to back our friends and allies who are fighting them and defeating them all the way until our friends and allies actually win. That's the way that you stop this from getting out of hand.
I hate the fact that I have to ask this question, but I just want you to clear something up. We are hearing all over the place, including from the PhD foreign policy analysts, former military people, and general idiots on Twitter, that Israel provoked this by attacking a diplomatic facility, and that any nation would do the same thing if their diplomatic facility was attacked. I mean, I saw U.S. colonel, whose name I will not mention here, retired colonel, actually compared it to the Al-Qaeda attacks on our embassies in East Africa and how we responded to that. Can you just walk us through why that is idiotic thinking? Not to load the question too much.
Well, this is one of those, you pick an event more or less at random in the past and you start there. In a war that's been going on for 40 years. And that's a little bit problematic because we can then say, well, who started that war? And the answer is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which started that war actually in the first instance with us by attacking our embassy. and then with Israel by forming Hezbollah and doing all of the things that they've done since then. The Iranians have been waging war on us and Israel for the entire duration of the existence of this regime. Who did the Iranians...
I think their first act was storming a U.S. embassy, I recall.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Which is an act of war, by the way. and to which we responded by trying to rescue hostages. Not by bombing the snot out of the Islamic Republic, which is interesting. Look, the Israelis killed a senior IRGC general... who has been responsible for building and maintaining and running a massive network that has been fueling weapons, proxies, experts, and others who have been attacking Israel on a regular basis, not from Iran, but from Lebanon and Syria, and also from Gaza. Zahedi, who was the IRGC general that the Israelis killed, had that portfolio for the entire Levant, for the Quds Force. This is a legitimate military target. This is a guy who was running a war against Israel and the Israelis took him out. So if you want to talk about who's right and who's wrong, you have to start with, okay, is our position that the Israelis don't have a right to take shots at IRGC officers who are running active military campaigns against Israel? Yeah, they do. Now, if you want to say that the Iranians have a right to respond to that, I can say, okay, if you want to regard this as a war between Israel and Iran, and if your position is neutral in that war, then you can say, well, you know, the Iranians had a cop coming. Personally, I'm not neutral when it's a contest between our allies and our enemies. So I'm not really interested in the Iranian justification for that. People who are neutral in that position, I think, ought to reflect on why they're neutral.
Yes, a lot more reflection is required in this country for a lot of people. I want to turn to Ukraine, Fred, because you just got back from an important trip. I don't want to say that your hair was on fire, because that's a cliche. But
I don't have that much hair anyway.
Well, far be it for me to impugn your hirsute nature. But I think there are a couple of things that our listeners would like to know about. First of all, just the state of the conflict. Second of all, where the Russians are headed with this, because I think that there are a lot of people who think this is a war with finite goals for the Russians, right? Oh, no, they just want to destroy Ukraine, or they just want, you know, these territories back, or they just want to protect Russian speakers or whatever it is, and what this means. And finally, what this means for NATO. And then maybe we'll follow up with a discussion about, you know, how these are all interconnected.
Look, Mark did a good job of laying this out to begin with. Putin has told us what his objectives are, and his objectives include reconstituting some combination of the Soviet Union and the Russian Empire. The nuance is important because, of course, the Russian Empire also included Finland and most of Poland. And the Russians have been very clear that they're very vague about exactly where they think their borders end. And they've said things like Russia's borders never end. And so we need to, there is no basis in the Kremlin propaganda to be confident that we know how limited Russian ambitions are, when the Russians, in fact, are identifying pretty unlimited ambitions. That's Putin's objective. He says it all the time. He's written it personally multiple times. He articulates it all the time. And more importantly than that, he is building it into an ideology in Russia that is now being taken and developed by people who are even crazier than he is into some really strange places that should really worry us, because Putin is not going to live forever, which is a good thing. But there is every reason to think that anybody who succeeds him is going to be more aggressive and crazier than he is. And that should really alarm us, because Putin is beginning the process of really rearming Russia. And one of the other things we need to take into account here is, right, we watched the Russians be stupid and incompetent in 2022. We watched them take a very long time to learn. They're still tactically incompetent. They still don't look good fighting. But here's where my PhD does come in handy, because my PhD in Soviet military history. And the thing that people don't understand about the Soviets is the Red Army was always tactically incompetent. It didn't get to Moscow simply by steamrolling the Germans with masses of humanity, however. It got to Berlin by being smart at higher levels of war, by designing campaigns that its incompetent soldiers could execute. We never really understood that. We've always had a problem with this, but this is now what we're seeing the Russians doing. The Russians are designing intelligent campaigns that take account of the fact that their soldiers are no good, and that take account of Ukrainian weaknesses and vulnerabilities that are emerging because the United States has suspended aid. And so the Russians are going to continue developing in this regard. And they're going to, I'll come back to where the war is at right now. If the Russians win in Ukraine, we're going to find a Russian army on the NATO border from the Black Sea to the Arctic. And that's going to have some pretty devastating consequences for us. We don't need to worry about defending Romania right now, because the border with Russia is hundreds of miles to the east. We don't need to worry about defending Hungary or Slovakia or southern Poland, for that matter, because those borders are covered by a friendly Ukraine. If the Russians actually win and we have Russian army along that entire frontier, our defense requirements go up enormously. And we're going to publish, our friends at the Institute for the Study of War are going to be publishing a product in the next couple of days showing what I'm calling the optometrist chart. you know, do you prefer A or B? A is we have to defend the Baltic states with a friendly Ukraine in control of most of its territory, and we don't have to argue about exactly where the eastern border is right now. But we'll have the second largest army in Europe and will be extremely pro-NATO and friendly to us, whether it's a member state or not. That's A. Or B, you have a Russia-controlled Ukraine with the Russian forces all along the NATO border. I'm going to tell you, when you look at the charts and you look at the maps, I don't think we win the second war. I don't think we can defend the Baltics if the Russians have all of Ukraine. I really don't. I think that military operation is almost impossible to imagine us succeeding in. Whereas if you have a strong Ukraine that is friendly to us, right just south of where the rear areas of the Russian forces that would be attacking the Baltics, that's going to look very bad for the Russians. And I think that is your likeliest scenario in which they decide this is not a good idea, which is what we're going for, because that's basically deterrence, right? Every day you want your enemy to wake up and say, not today. And that's the way to do that, is to have Ukraine succeed and hold the ground that it has. So where are we now? As you've said, we have the problem that people are talking now about a fictional world in which the United States does not resume providing aid to Ukraine and the front lines remain about where they are. That is a fictional universe. That is not a real option. The Ukrainians are running out of air defenses because we're not giving them more air defense interceptors and systems. They have had to pull all their air defenses back to defend Kyiv and critical infrastructure. So the Ukrainian frontline troops are almost entirely exposed, and we're seeing, for the first time in this war, we're seeing the Russians use tactical aviation to launch thousands of glide bombs on Ukrainian frontline troops and just blow them away. And basic Russian tactic here is there's a village that the Russians want to move into. They start by obliterating it with glide bombs, so there's nothing for the Ukrainians to defend. Then they pound the Ukrainian forces, and then they drive forward. That lack of air defense, which is allowing the Russians to do this, is interacting with the lack of artillery on the Ukrainian side. So the Ukrainians have been incredibly clever here. And the Ukrainians have got this great drone system, and they're working on that, although they don't have money for it now, which in part because we haven't provided the aid, which is important. But drones, the drones they have don't kill tanks, and they don't can't kill lots of tanks. If you want to kill lots of tanks, you need artillery. So the fact that the Ukrainians don't have artillery means that the Russians are able to put armored columns into the field to take advantage of this air bombardment that they're able to do. So what's happening? The Ukrainians are losing ground all along the line. Right now, the line is not stalemated. The line is not stable. The Ukrainians are being forced back right now. And they're actually being forced back now, and they're in danger of losing, for the first time in a long time, a settlement that actually really matters. And ISW has published on this. The settlement is called Chasiv Yar. It's west of the city of Bakhmut. And it is part of the fortress belt that protects eastern Ukraine right now. And the Ukrainians are in real danger of losing that settlement. That would be a very big loss. That's already happening. And that's even with Ukraine having some artillery, some air defense. If we don't get U.S. military assistance going there soon, the Ukrainians are going to lose the limited ability that they have to defend their airspace. They're going to lose even more artillery capability as they fire through the rounds that they have. And by the end of the year, you're going to start to see the front lines crumbling, especially because we know what the Russians are preparing to do. So Putin has seen the vulnerability that we have helped create by withholding the aid. Normally at this time of year, the Russians would be in a lower operation tempo period preparing for a summer offensive. That's not what they're doing. They're leaning all in right now to take advantage of this gap, which I hope will just be a gap, in provision of supplies. But they're also preparing for a summer offensive. And the summer offensive that they're preparing for appears to be a ground attack toward Kharkiv City that could happen late this summer. Now, there are two scenarios here. If the Ukrainians had the stuff they need to fight, I'm confident they would be able to stop that attack. If we don't give them any aid, I'm not at all confident that they can stop that attack. And Kharkiv is the second largest city in Ukraine. It's right there near the border. The Ukrainians stopped it before. They stopped that attack in 22, and they stopped it after that. They could stop it again if we gave them what they need. If we don't, though, we're in a whole other world. So the forecast cone here is very, very wide. And we are starting to see some very, very dangerous outcomes coming into that forecast cone. And those include the collapse of the Ukrainian line and Russian forces streaming toward the western border. That can happen later this year and especially next year in 2025 if we don't provide any more assistance. On the other hand, the Russians still suffer from very serious limitations and vulnerabilities. And if we provided the Ukrainians with what they need, the Ukrainians would be able to take advantage of those. They would for sure be able to stop the Russian advances, and they probably would even be able to retake some important ground. It really is up to us what the outcome of this conflict is going to be in the next year and a half.
I want you to walk us through the list of horribles a little bit more. So right now, as you've described it, the Ukrainians have pulled back their limited air defenses from the front line. So they're exposing their troops to the front lines. And one of their disadvantages in the war is a manpower disadvantage, right? So the more Ukrainians who die unnecessarily in the front, the harder it will be in the long term for them to have, you know, we're now reducing Zelensky just reduced the age of for the draft to 25 from 27. They don't have a lot of manpower. But then eventually the air defenses are depleted for Kyiv and for other Ukrainian cities. What happens then? Are we going to see an Aleppo-style bombing of Ukrainian cities? Are we going to see refugee flows? I mean, walk us through what happens if the House Republicans, and I use that term deliberately, not Congress, the House Republicans cut off aid to Ukraine.
We're already seeing the parts of that in the border areas. So the Russians are bombing Kharkiv with all kinds of missiles and bombs and actually doing fearsome damage to the city. The Russians are also, of course, doing fearsome damage to the electrical grid. And they're able to do that because the Ukrainians have to choose their shots. And the Ukrainians are saying this. The Ukrainians have to knowingly let missiles hit things that they know are going to matter because they just don't have enough interceptors to shoot all the targets that they're seeing, even when they know that they should. That's going to get worse and worse. So are we going to start to see Russians bombing Kyiv? Yeah. Sure. We're going to start to see the Russians pushing their envelope toward bombing the major Ukrainian frontline cities. Kyiv is close enough to both Belarus and Russia that Russians will get after it, although the Ukrainians will defend that to the last. But there are other big frontline cities that the Russians can go after. Zaporizhia is a large city. It's not far from the front line. Dnipro is a large city, not far from the front line. That fortress belt I described, there's several hundred thousand Ukrainians in those cities. As air defense crumbles and the Ukrainians have to pull it back so that it's just Kyiv, yeah, you're going to start to see Russian fixed wing over those sites. And some of that is going to start to look like Aleppo because this is the Russian strategy. Because remember, the Russians, I mean, we want to remember, of course, the whole point of this war is that Putin is saving the Russian-speaking peoples in Ukraine from the horrors of the Kyiv government, right? So naturally, the thing to do is to bomb them into extinction. But that's exactly what he's doing, which, by the way, ought to give us some pause about accepting his rhetorical justification for this war. This is an interesting way to go about saving people. Yes, they will start doing this. They will do it because they want to destroy anything that the Ukrainians can use to defend. And urban terrain is good to defend. And so you destroy it, and then it's easier to take. Yes, we're absolutely going to see that
happen.
Okay,
and so the Russian forces, I'm imagining the scenario now where the aid's cut off. Russian forces start advancing, putting more Ukrainian cities come under aerial bombardment as the missile interceptors are depleted. Refugee flows from Ukrainian cities, because right now, most Ukrainian cities, because of the air defense, people can live relatively normal lives. But as soon as it becomes like Aleppo, they're going to be fleeing. They probably don't take Kyiv this year, which means they will take it. They would be on the verge of taking it when and under the next president, who Republicans hope will be Donald Trump. What kind of a situation would Trump be inheriting if he was elected as president if we don't cut off this aid?
Whoever's president in January 2025 is going to have a terrible situation if aid is not rapidly resumed. It'll be a terrible situation. You're going to have Ukrainian lines collapsing. You're going to have Russian forces driving toward the NATO borders. You're going to have millions of refugees fleeing Ukraine into Europe. You're going to have Ukrainian cities being bombed, and it's just going to get worse. So whoever's president in January 2025 is going to have to make an immediate decision. And the decision is going to be, do I preside over the final collapse of Ukraine, the emergence of the largest insurgency the world has ever seen, and the arrival of Russian forces on the Western NATO border? Or do I turn around and try to find some way desperately to help the Ukrainians stave this off with massive aid packages and so forth, which may not be possible to do at that point? At the same time, by the way, you've got Europeans talking about the stage at which they send their own troops into Ukraine because they do understand the dangers to NATO and Europe of allowing the Russians just to win here. So there's all kinds of complicated situation that the next president could face right away as the first decisions that he has to make. That is very likely to be the case if the U.S. does not resume aid. You want to talk about negotiating with Putin? I have real questions about whether negotiating with this particular dragon is likely to lead to positive results, but I'll set those aside for the moment. If you want to talk about that, the next president will have virtually no leverage if aid is not resumed. Putin is basically saying this, by the way. Putin is basically saying he's leaning forward right now because he wants to have the greatest possible leverage and be in a position to dictate terms to the next president, whoever that might be. And that's what's going to happen. If there is no aid, we're not going to have any leverage. And so Putin will dictate terms. And we know what the terms are that he will dictate. And they will be catastrophically to our disadvantage.
That's absolutely true. So, Fred, exit question, and I know you've got a lot going on because I've got some appointments with you, and you've got work on Capitol Hill. So, you've been more than generous as always. One of the things that used to drive me crazy about leaders like Yasser Arafat, the late leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization, was that he believed that he could run two separate policies, one in English and one in Arabic, right? It was always great because he would say, yes, I want peace, blah, 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 blah. And then in Arabic, he'd be like, kill the Jews. And it strikes me forcibly that we also have these weird beliefs. We believe that our posture towards Ukraine will not influence the Iranian assessments and the Chinese assessments. We believe that the Israeli capabilities will not be noticed by the Russians and the Chinese. And, you know, we could go on and on and on. But this is not, this is, to use a really bad cliche, an interconnected world. Can you just paint a little picture for people about who is seeing what in the last week or so of developments? And add in, and I know you don't like to talk politics, and Mark and I do, but add in how the Russians and others are also seeing the debates going on here in Washington.
Yeah, look, I mean, I've heard a lot of Republicans saying, I think accurately, that the catastrophic, unnecessary withdrawal from Afghanistan encouraged Putin to invade Ukraine. That's also my assessment. I think that that's true. Okay. The same will hold if Republicans pull the plug on Ukraine for China and Taiwan. Also for Iran in the Middle East. Our enemies are not as sophisticated as we sometimes think they are. Our enemies, you know, we think often that one party, you know, we can oppose the president, but we can say that we'll be tough when we're in power, and that our enemies will be influenced by that. The thing is, there's only one United States at a time. And our enemies don't parse things this finely. They look to see, is the United States acting in its interests or not? Is the United States defending its interests and its allies or not? They're not asking questions about, well, the Republicans are not doing that right now, but we know that they will when they come into office. That's not the way that people are thinking. And in fact, in this particular case, I think there is something that's even more toxic to our long-term security and safety going on. Think about the precedent that we're actually about on the verge of establishing if aid is not resumed. The precedent is that regardless of how much it might be in America's interest to support a particular partner or ally or to do something, the opposition party will not support a president of the opposing party. That's the basic principle that we would be establishing here. Okay. Well, if Republicans are confident that they're going to control Congress and the White House for the rest of eternity, I suppose they could decide that they don't have to worry about that. That seems an implausible political outcome to me. So do we think that this will not be the case if we establish this precedent now for a Democrat Congress and a Republican president? I think our enemies are going to see that in any event. And our enemies are going to conclude the United States has fundamentally paralyzed itself in the world. And we are allowing our partisanship to trump our interests in a way that will permanently paralyze us.
So exit question from me. On Capitol Hill today, you're seeing a lot of Republicans who are Iran hawks and Russia doves. And you are seeing a lot of Democrats who are Russia hawks and Iran doves. Can you be that bifurcated, or can you be tough on Iran but not tough on Russia, or vice versa, or tough on Russia but not tough on Iran?
No, you can't be an Iran hawk and a Russia dove, and you really can't be a Russia hawk and Iran dove either. This is a coalition that is moving close toward being a military alliance. They're using, as we've talked about, the same weapons, the same tactics. They're covering for one another. By the way, North Korea is part of that alliance, and we've seen the Russians importantly cover for the North Koreans at the Security Council by blocking the renewal of the monitoring mission for sanctions there. And of course, the Chinese are part of this coalition as well. These states see themselves in a way that's sort of similar to the way the Axis powers saw themselves in World War II. They had diverging interests. They didn't agree about lots of things. They didn't always coordinate all their activities, but they understood a few things. And one of those things they all understood was America was an enemy, Britain was an enemy, France was an enemy, and it was in their collective interest for each one of them to do what they could to damage those enemies. That's what this enemy entente that we're facing right now sees. And they're all working together. And this is kind of tragic to me, but, you know, the North Koreans and the Iranians are being better allies to the Russians than we are to our partners. And that fact is not being missed in the world. You can't separate these things. We're facing one block of enemies that sees us as the enemy, and we have to resist all of them. Right now, we have the luxury of not doing the fighting ourselves. This is the thing that's most upsetting about the situation that we're in. No one's asking us to fight in Ukraine. We helped defend the Israelis against missile defense. We're trying hard not to get drawn into a war in the Middle East. I'd rather not get drawn into a war in the Middle East. We still have that option. If we show weakness all along the line, and if we allow the Russians to win in Ukraine, if we allow the Iranians to continue to rampage unchecked in the Middle East, we are going to find ourselves having to fight these wars ourselves with our own people. That would be a catastrophic failure of American national security, and I fear that that's where we're headed if we don't help our allies and partners right now carry out the wars that they are currently fighting.
Amen. That is so true. You know, we're acting like a banana republic and have the policies to match. Thank you, Fred. Thank you for also taking all these trips, putting yourself in danger so that you could come on our podcast and tell us about it.
Thanks. From a safe distance away from me and Danny.
Right. Danny said from her couch. Thank you for all of the fantastic work that you and the Critical Threats Project team are doing, and that Kim Kagan and all of the team are doing at ISW. I rely on you more than I can say, and I'm really proud to say that I see a lot of other people do too.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Danny, what do you think?
So, Mark, one of the things that we don't talk an awful lot about is politics here. And all I want to say is that, you know, you and I reminisce a lot and we're like old people. Boy, was it better in our days. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is when you have a weak president, as we did, for example, with Bill Clinton, Congress plays an absolutely critical role. You can lead, okay? The right thing to do is for Democrats who want to lead to drag Republicans along, for Republicans who want to lead to drag Democrats along, but to fill the vacuum that is caused by an incredibly weak and impotent White House. And what we are now seeing is that everybody is abdicating responsibility, right? It is not that they're leading on Ukraine. It is not that they're leading on Israel. It is not that they're leading on anything except for trolling on Twitter. They're really good leaders about that. And I want to see Congress take up the reins again.
We'll see if that happens. Look, here's the thing that Republicans on Capitol Hill need to understand when it comes to Ukraine. If you don't pass this aid, you are going to own it. And it's going to be ugly. It's going to get ugly soon. You're going to see carpet bombing of cities. You're going to see a humanitarian catastrophe. You're going to see massive refugee flows. You're going to see Russian troops start taking Ukrainian cities. And it's going to start on Biden's watch, but it's going to end on Trump's watch. He gets elected in November and takes office in January 2020. And the Russians will be on Kyiv's doorstep in his watch. And then he'll have to decide, do I want to let them do it or not? And if your goal is to strengthen Donald Trump and help him get a peace deal like he says he will, you should probably want him to not inherit a foreign policy catastrophe in Ukraine where the Russians are advancing, the Ukrainians are on their heels, and he has no leverage. So even if you think the war in Ukraine should end, you certainly don't want it to end in defeat on Donald Trump's watch. So even if you don't care about what's happening in Ukraine and you just care about politics and Donald Trump, it's not in your interest not to pass this aid package. We need to get the aid to the Ukrainians so that he can inherit a stable situation. And if all that happens, it's going to be your Afghanistan. It's going to be, and just look at Joe Biden and what Afghanistan did to him. He was at 50% approval before the Afghan withdrawal, and after the Taliban took Kabul, he dropped below 50 and never recovered. And he is now the most unpopular president in the history of the country for a lot of reasons, but it started with Afghanistan. And you can create the same conditions for Trump coming into the White House if you want. Just go ahead, cut off the aid.
Words to the wise. Listen to Mark's advice. Friends on Capitol Hill, Democrats and Republicans, there are still good people up there. Do your best. Thanks for all your hard work, too. Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks especially to Kat for helping us in the absence of Ben, our producer.
Take care.
Let us know what topics you'd like us to cover. You can get in touch with the show by emailing us at whatthehell@aei.org.
Or you can reach us on Twitter. I'm at D. Pletka.
And I'm at Mark Thiessen. That's Mark with a C.
Please rate and review the podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, share it, comment on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this.
Thanks for listening.